All right, fine. I'll be a gracious host. How you doing?
Little Mermaid is the scariest Disney movie by far, though.
Why the hell is Ace Blade in your Kickstarter?
Some comics. I'm getting controversial today. We're gonna get controversial today with
my proudest moment is this interview and being able to talk to you too.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, Taurus Comics, in collaboration with Fourth Wall Productions, respectfully brings to you the 76th episode of the Four Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Kyron Silver from Taurus Comics. Across the way is a purple reporter of Ace Blade, Danny J. Quick, and together we are your two award-winning Blurred comic creators here to help you find your next favorite comic. We are live on the Age to Geekdom Network via Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube. So if you're listening and watching us live, thank you for your support. But don't forget to like, subscribe, share, and review our podcast, because all your positive reviews and interactions help us in reaching a bigger audience. DJ Quick, what's going on, man?
I'm doing good, man. How you doing?
Oh, man. I'm stressed out, actually.
Really?
Very stressed. Yes.
The Kickstarter is stressing you out?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like that, man. It's a whole thing. I'm already bald, but I lost more space in my bald spot during this campaign.
Man, I sent in my Kickstarter for issue 4 of Solid Lightning Wielder. Mm-hmm. Got 2 days ago now? Was that yesterday or 2 days ago? I don't remember.
I think it was 2 days ago.
And it's still in the review. And I know that's stupid because they take a while, but I've had a Kickstarter get reviewed in like half an hour and got approved.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
it's weird because they went to, from what I heard, I don't know this, but from what I heard, they went to a 4-day work week. So depending on who's reviewing your Kickstarter, if it's at the beginning of the week or the end of the week, it might just take 4 or 5 days, you know, three business days that they're supposed to take. So,
okay.
It's like that.
Orlando is in the chat. Good morning, Orlando. Thanks for joining us again.
What's happening, man? It's good to see you. Up and at 'em.
Yeah. We're about to do our what books we read this week, right? Or you had no wait, you had a rant.
I do have a rant, but it's a rant against myself. Okay. So I don't know if I decided recently that I was going to sell my comic book most of my comic book collection. All right. So I got probably 600 comics in here that I just been collecting over the years, you know, but
only 600.
Yeah. Only 600. You know, I've only literally been reading comics for like 10 years now. So
God, that's so small.
It's crazy. It's crazy. But that's such a small amount of books to have collected. But I decided, I was like, all right, I need to for my personal collection, you know, I'm going to shrink it down to 100 books. I'm going to keep 100 books for myself. I want to stay under 20 graded books. But my indie books is a separate thing. So I'm keeping my indie books because I'm reading those. So the indie books that I have, I probably got 200 indie books alone. But, you know, just for the store and for, you know, because I want to build up, you know, kind of not the retailer, but the you know, the people who go out and sell and trade comic books and stuff. You know, I want to kind of build up that profile.
Okay.
So in doing that, I decided to go through my comics and, you know, see which ones I wanted to keep. And last week I told you I was reading Far Sector.
Yeah, right? You did. So, yeah.
Reading back through Far Sector. So I went and I found my Far Sector books. I found my Far Sector comics. And I was like, I should sell these. You know, I know the story. I got the trade now. I should sell these. Turns out I have all of them except for book number 6.
All right.
All of them except for book number 6.
Okay.
So now the conundrum is, do I go out and buy number 6 to complete the set, or do I just sell them the way that they are? Or do I just buy number 6 and then put this as part of my 100 books that I have? You know what I'm saying? Like, my brain won't turn off the, I want to have the complete set. I love this series. You know, it was great to me. So, you know, this might just be 12 of the books that I keep, but that, you know, takes out a lot of space from the 100 books that I want to, you know, shut it down to. So maybe I'll expand it. I don't know. I don't know what to do.
My thoughts. If you can buy number six for cheap, do that. Like, just do a quick search, go eBay, find if you can find it cheap. Mm-hmm. If you can't find it cheap, sell it as is and just say the whole series without issue six. Just let everybody know, hey, this is everything without issue six. Mm-hmm. My other issue is, how the hell do you still only have 600 comics? I was thinking about that. I was like, I got 18 long boxes in my closet right now. And I think about each long box holds about 200 comics. So I got like almost 4,000 comics.
Bruh, that's ridiculous. How long you been collecting books?
About 35 years now.
Yeah. I'm super young. I didn't even start really collecting comics until I, like, because, you know, I started reading comics when I started making comic books, right? Yeah. So, you know, as an adult, I've only been making comics 10 years. And the last, and I didn't even know what I wanted to collect. I was just buying stuff that I thought was cool. And then, you know, it started to grow. So,
okay.
It's weird, bro. Hey, yeah. And everybody's not independently wealthy like you. So everybody can't just have 4,000 comic books in their house or in their
apparently from y'all. I'm living off my retirement money, so I'm good.
Justin is right though. Justin is right though. He said, yeah, it's gonna bother me now I don't have the whole set. Now I gotta complete the set before I can sell it. But when I complete the set, I'm not gonna want to sell it. I'm gonna be like, oh, I like these, I'm gonna keep them.
And Justin on Facebook also is right. He says that your little collection is cute. But I want to see, I mean, we spent a good time talking. I want to see about the guest we have today and see what kind of a collection he has. I mean,
absolutely.
He's probably been collecting comics for a good amount of time, and not respectfully, that not about his age.
What's crazy is that I was looking through his bio and I was like, oh, he's been making comics as long as I've been alive. Like, I was born in 1985, and I want to say his first publication was 1986 or late 1985. So, absolutely glad to have our guest on today.
All right. Well, I mean, do you have an intro for him? You sounded like you're about to go off on something.
All right, go ahead. You got it.
Oh, okay. Wow. We have the amazing Ben Dunn on the line today from Antarctic Press. He's been around for, like you said, a long time creating comics, but creating a plethora of comics. So, Ben, thank you for being on the show today.
Yes, sir. Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, gentlemen.
So, all right. So, you know, we were talking about our comic books. I do want to know roughly how many comics do you think you have in your collection, if you still have one?
Yeah, I do have a collection. Presently, I probably think I got maybe about 1,000 or so. I mean, I've collected a long time and I've gone through many collections, bought, sold. But now I just focus on just stuff I really like and just focus on that, you know. And then, you know what they say, you collect what you love and you'll never be disappointed.
Okay. That's right. I'm in that vein now. I'm like, I need to, because a lot of these books, you know, I bought to read them or whatever. And now I'm at the point where, like, I want to keep certain stuff I want to keep for myself. But the rest of the stuff I can sell. Or,
I hear you, man. I haven't bought any modern comics in a long time. I feel if I'm going to pay $4, $5, $6 for a new comic, I might as well, you know, buy an old Bronze Age or Silver Age book for the same price, you know?
Right.
I'll probably get a lot more enjoyment out of those books.
Right.
So first thing we want to do, like we've been doing the last couple of weeks, is want to go through and see what everybody's been reading this week. So Ben, you're a guest. Can you, to our crowd of people here, what comics have you been reading this week?
Truthfully, I haven't read any. I mean, I read a lot of independent comics, but I haven't read any Marvel or DC in a long, long time. I mostly read books that people send me, you know, like a lot of guys that I know, they just send me comics for me to read. I read a lot of just books I get out of the dollar bins whenever I go to a convention or stuff like that. So, I mean, I'm trying to expand my repartee, so to speak. So, I've been buying mostly just oddball comics, like, you know, romance and horror comics and cartoon comics, you know, non-superhero comics, believe it or not. You know, just to see what the writing is like, see what the art is like, you know, because some of these non-superhero comics, they had really long lives. I mean, before, you know, before comics became almost strictly superhero, there was a lot of genres, you know, Western, science fiction, and things like that. And I just wanted to open my horizons, so to speak, to see, you know, what made them, you know, popular or different, or, you know, what the writing style was like, who the art was like, and things like that. So, you know, that's what I'm mostly into now.
Nice. Okay.
Oh yeah, we're all about the indie comics. Most of the stuff that I read these days is is indie comics. You know, I still go to the store and support, you know, a couple of mainstream titles. But my guy Jermaine Exum, he's at the store and he knows what I'm gonna like, so he just picks books out for me. And then whenever I come in, he's like, "Here, check these out." So,
well, that's interesting because, you know, I believe that. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, indie comics were just sort of like a niche type thing, you know, so you're to occupy a corner of the comic book store. But now it's really gotten way accepted. You know, it's getting to the forefront because the quality of the indies now are on par, if not surpassing, a lot of the quote unquote mainstream comics nowadays. I mean, the talent that has arisen in the last 5, 10, 15 years has been astonishing. I mean, I can see it just based on the submissions I've been getting, you know, based on the crowdfunding projects I've been seeing, you know, and just in the general look and feel of these indie comics. It's just astonishing to me how much headway indie comics have made into the market.
Yeah, I mean, we both noticed that too. Danny and I are both, you know, comic creators on our own for independent scene. What would you say is the biggest reason of this wealth of talent now coming into independent scene? Is it just the access to internet where we can talk to more people? Is it just general evolution?
Yeah, that's definitely a factor. You know, the fact that the internet allows you to expose yourself to way more people than it previous. I mean, the fall of the gatekeepers is what really. Is that used to be, there was like what you had to go through a publisher traditionally, you know, and now you don't have to. You can do your stuff directly, straight to the people, direct to the consumer, you know, and that gives you a lot of unfettered freedom, you know, and it gives you and it's almost like a purely capitalist system where you just, you know, your work survives or thrives based on the product you produce. You know, people love your stuff, they'll give you money for it and they'll support you. If they don't, they'll let you know, and then you have, it's up to you to change it or modify it or to, you know, tweak it so that it can be a success.
Mm-hmm. Now you have a Kickstarter going right now for Tomorrow Girl. Speaking of people giving you money for things that they like, can you tell us about what Tomorrow Girl is, what the Kickstarter is about, things like that?
Yeah, Tomorrow Girl is sort of my, you know, I love, you know, old classic superheroes. I mean, I grew up with Silver Age and Bronze Age books, and I wasn't much into Golden Age because I always thought the art was kind of crude and the story's very simplistic. But this is my character to sort of an homage or throwback to those earlier, simpler times when, you know, characters were had a set strict code of morals, you know, but I throw a little manga spin in there so that it's has also sort of a slice of life type feel to it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like a combination of like a Silver Age manga. You know, it's a character that's been around for a long time. I created her like in 1992, but she was never she was always a background character. You know, she was never a main supporting character. So, but when I did a crossover with Common America, that thrusted her into the forefront and people really started liking her. So I decided to start doing her own series, and it's proven to be pretty popular. So I decided to let the new readers know that she's been, character's been around for a long time, and I wanted to get them up to date on all her past adventures.
I love it. I love it. So before we get into your comic book history and going back to the beginning, like we like to do, Justin has a question in the comments, and I'd like to hear both of y'all's perspective on this one. So Justin is a good friend of mine, and he's recently gotten into reading comics and interested in the comic book business and things like that. And he wants to know, what's the criteria for a comic to be considered mainstream? Do you think it's the publication? Do you think it's the amount of time or how many books are coming out a year, or, you know, maybe, you know, the infrastructure that the company has that's publishing it?
Oh, that's a pretty tricky question. What is mainstream to begin with? I mean, is that the ability to get your material to a large audience through traditional means like bookstores and comic stores and such? And because in that case, independent comics are mainstream. You can get them in bookstores. You've seen them in bookstores and comic stores. So that's, you know, no longer. I mean, does it mean that a vast majority of people recognize the character? Well, that's not always true either. Marvel and DC have, you know, minor characters that have their own series that very few people know anything about. You know, so I would think that anything you do that is in the eyes of the public is mainstream. You know, it's just a matter of whether you can get that IP or creation, you know, into a large enough audience that people will start to recognize it right away.
Right.
You know, and that takes a lot of work.
It absolutely does. What would you say, Kyron? What comics would you determine as to be considered mainstream?
I mean, like Ben said, it's a complicated word to say mainstream. It's sort of like the struggle that we have with saying what is independent self-publishing type of thing. It's a gray area. I mean, most of the stuff that comes out of Marvel DC, I guess you could probably say is mainstream, but I think if you're getting to a book where it's being sold on a monthly basis to like tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, that's closer to what I would say mainstream is. But I don't think there is a true rule as far as what mainstream is supposed to be anymore. I think,
Things can come out of the blue that suddenly become mainstream. Here's a good example, like Walking Dead. That was an Image comic that came out. You know, it was another zombie book. Nobody really cared. Nobody really gave it much thought. And then when the TV, option for a TV series, bam, it was suddenly, quote unquote, mainstream, you know, because a lot of people were exposed to it.
Yeah. That's actually what I was going to say is a good example of Walking Dead. And I think Invincible is getting to that now with their cartoon series, even things like The Boys. These are all books that had a following, but until they were on a streaming service or on TV, no one really cared too much about it. Yeah. And now that they're exposed now, people are like, oh, let me go back and read this series.
So. Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. And for Justin's follow-up question, for me, I just say indie comics to me are just self-published comics that don't have, you know, traditional distribution and infrastructure, you know, so something that's pretty much self-published, you know, and that doesn't have, you know, that major notoriety like comics from the big two to have. So there's not a distinct line that separates what's indie and mainstream, you know.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because the traditional is falling away to the new paradigm. I mean, the fact of the matter is things like webtoons and global comics and a lot of digital platforms that now carry comics, I mean, they can reach potentially billions of people, you know, and that is that considered mainstream? I mean, if you had that many eyeballs on a comic, I mean, yeah, I would think that would be mainstream, you know? So it's a... You have that flexibility now where you can go through different avenues of distribution. You know, the thing is that we can't be caught up in, the old traditional ways we shouldn't abandon, okay, because the Hollywood is learning that lesson very quickly. But we could also embrace the new as well, you know, and incorporate them so that the both old and the new ways can thrive together.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm interested in your comic book origins. I want to know, what our show usually does is we go back to the beginning for folks, and you know, we want to know how you got into comics. What was your first jobs, and you know, what was your how did you become interested in making comic books in the first place?
When I was a kid, I loved reading the newspaper strips. You know, when newspapers carried comic strips, I would voraciously devour them. I'm more of a visual person. I had probably had undiagnosed ADHD or something when I was a kid, because I had a hard time reading text, but I could easily read text. It was accompanied by a picture. So comics, I was just drawn to comics. And they were cheap. You know, comics back then were meant for kids to pick up with very little allowance money. And we didn't have internet or things like that to keep us occupied. So comics was a really inexpensive, diversionary entertainment. And you could read them over and over and over again, you know, dissect them, do whatever you wanted with them, and copy the pictures. I mean, they were a great source of entertainment. So I just love comics. It was just a fantastic way to be entertained, you know, as a little kid. And then growing up, I just started reading more and more and more comics. And I started dealing comics to my classmates, you know, started drawing them because I just wanted to, I wanted to be a comic book artist, you know, but growing up Asian was not easy because, most traditional Asian families, they look down upon that as being sort of like a trash job, you know, something that's not to be taken seriously. But I wasn't deterred. I decided I wanted to do comics, and that's what I wanted. So, and then in college, I borrowed $5,000, and I started Antarctic Press, and started publishing my own comics. And we've been doing it ever since. You know, so I figured if I can't get into Marvel and DC, I'm just going to do my own books because at that time, Eastman and Laird came out with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and that was a huge game changer. You know, indie comics were always considered like I said, the niche, you know, sort of small time. But when the Turtles came out, that just opened the floodgates to the direct market and to indie comics, and it just thrust it black and white books on the forefront. And it hasn't changed ever since. Yeah. And so we've been publishing books continuously for 35 plus years, and we hope to do it for another 35 plus years.
Wow. That's crazy. And just going back to the comments, you were saying how, you know, when you're younger, being Asian, it wasn't something that your family was really appreciative of. And
no.
I still get that with my in-laws. They still, every time I see them, they're like, "You're still making those comic books?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm still doing it."
Those funny books? Yeah. Still doing those funny books? When are you going to get a real job?
Yeah, no, it's still something. And I think there is a good portion of society, not just in the Asian community, but society in general, that looks at comic books and they're like, okay, that's a side thing. That's a hobby. That's not a real job. But you've shown for 35 years, like you said, you're able to make comics. You can make a living on it. There are people out there. I mean, I don't know about your financial situation, so I'm not going to guess on it. but there are people out there that are making, you know, millions of dollars doing this. What drives you to keep making comics? Is it just, you know, the love of the medium? Is it just a paycheck at this point?
I love comics, and I love the people behind comics. You know, the people who create comics, there's something about them that's sort of special in my eyes. You know, the creativity, the imagination, you know, the drive to want to do something and create something out of whole cloth. I mean, it's just something I just really, really admire. You know, I'm not a rich man by any stretch of the imagination, though I wish I hope to be one day, you know, because there's a lot I could accomplish because, you know, all the money I make, I put back into creating more comics. You know, I mean, I could, you know, sit back and just do my own thing, but I love giving people the opportunity, you know, to get out there and you know, get their stuff exposed. Now, I mean, now publishers are not nearly as important as they used to be because of crowdfunding. You know, people can just do their own thing and not have to worry about it. But there is something special about seeing your comic in a comic book store, you know, being browsed by just the public at large. I mean, it's not, maybe not as important, but there is sort of a cachet behind that. So in that sense, you know, publishers still have some value in those terms, you know. So we like to embrace both sides. You know, we like to do the crowdfunding, but we also stick to the traditional model of getting comics into comic stores.
Mm-hmm. I'm following up on that because you brought up something that at least was important to me recently, is your idea of giving back and letting other people shine, and the idea of seeing their books in comic books and in a comic store. Antarctic Press has their exciting comic series, which you're now allowing other creators to put their books basically through your system and have it be showing up in comic book stores. How did that come about? Because I know when I got my chance and saw Lightning Wielder was featured for 4 issues, I was excited to see my book in the store and see my artwork as a cover. That was amazing for me.
Sure. I mean, I loved the, you know, it was a good looking character. It's very, the way you wrote it and drew it, it's on par with anything that, you know, Marvel and DC is doing. So yeah,
I figured, okay, we're clipping that so everybody can hear that Ben Dunn said my character's on par with anything Marvel and DC is creating.
I wouldn't have taken it otherwise. You know, it's really, you know, the thing is that, you know, I could I love anthologies. You know, when I proposed to do Revive Exciting Comics and all these anthologies, AP was very resistant at first. You know, they told me, oh, anthologies don't sell. You know, no one's doing anthologies anymore. You know, that's what happened. I said, no, look, guys, this is a way for us to do premiere new ideas, you know, give new creators an opportunity to get in comic stores and allow us to do it on a regular basis. We've been doing it, and they say, okay, fine, you edit it, and we'll do it. So I've been doing it for the last 38, 39 issues. You know, we're approaching our 40th issue on Exciting Comics, and we're just doing all sorts of, I'm doing all sorts of experimental stuff. You know, people send me submissions to of their crowdfunding projects. I mean, see, I don't restrict any creator from doing their own thing. You know, you do whatever you want to do. You give me the permission to do it in Exciting Comics. And that's just, you know, that's just gravy. You know, you can still make your money selling your own thing. And I get an opportunity to expose your work to the comic stores.
Love it. I think that's a great idea. And I know everybody who's been published in those books has probably seen it as, you know, a wonderful opportunity and is grateful for it. I'm going to be submitting about 10 projects within the next couple of months. So
I look forward to it. You'll keep me in issues for the next 5 years.
There we go. There we go.
Just expect a lot of purple characters coming through your
a lot of purple.
Nothing wrong with purple.
But I think that's awesome. One question that I had, when it comes to making comics, and I'm gonna get into this a little bit when it comes to quick takes. How do you, what is your perspective on you know, having a lot of different kind of comics books come out by a creator versus, you know, sticking to that one comic book, like right now you're working on Tomorrow Girl. Do you think it might distract you to work on a bunch of different projects at the same time, or do you, you know, have time to just focus on just the one thing that you love?
Well, it's different with every creator. I mean, we're all different in how we want to do things. I mean, like for instance, Jeff Smith, all he does is Bone. You know, that's one thing. Stan Sakai, all he does is Usagi Yojimbo. That's it. You know, Eric Larson, all he does is Savage Dragon. You know, so
if friend of the show, Eric Larson.
Yeah, I saw that. It was a really cool clip. But if you're happy with your one creation and you've made it so that you can actually make a living off of it, then there's no reason for you to change if you think you've got a lot of stories to tell using that character. You know, there's no, it's really up to the individual career. For me, I have a short attention span. So, you know, what I like to do is I like to do one project and then I'll come up with another idea and do another project because, you know, I can do it. And the, you know, the one advantage I do have is that I can draw my own stuff. You know, a lot of writers are in that situation where they have great ideas, but they can't draw. So they're sort of stuck in that nebulous zone where they have to have an artist put their idea on paper so that he can actually sell it as a comic. So I do have that advantage. So I can, if I decide, you know what, I'm just going to do something different, I can just sit down and draw it. So it's not a big deal for me. But for a lot of other creators, it can be an issue, you know. And also after 35 years of doing this, you know, I get into a certain rhythm. I get into a certain routine. I know I have to do X number of pages a day, you know, and I do them. And if I don't make my quota for the day, then, you know, I have to make it up the next day. So, right. You know, to maintain the schedule. So for me, it's about getting out product. You know, you gotta keep producing because I'm of the firm belief that if it's out of, you know, if it's not out of eyesight, it's out of your mind.
Out of sight, out of mind. That's true.
That's right.
Now, one thing we haven't touched upon is Warrior Nun was one of my favorite series coming out of Antarctica Press, and you were lucky enough to have that turned into a Netflix series. Can you give us quickly like a breakdown of how that process came about? Because a friend of mine is also having his comic turned into a series on FX, and I know from his perspective, it's been years in the making. Was that sort of same thing for you too? It took years for it to get to that point?
Yeah, it's really all depends. The timing is everything. Like you said, I was lucky. You know, the timing is everything. You know, and also it helps to have people who actually believe in your project. You know, because you can handle it one of several ways. One, you could attempt to try to do it yourself. But that takes a lot of time and effort, and you have to make connections, you got to do meetings, you know, and that takes away from your actual job of creating, you know, and that's what you really should be focused on. The main thing is that I had someone, we had actually started trying to do a Warrior Nun series as far back as 1996.
Oh, wow.
And we spent a good amount of money to do an animated pilot for Warrior Nun. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but it's on YouTube, you know, so you can check it out. We approached like a dozen production companies. You know, we went to Warner's, we went to Disney, we went to Madonna's production. We've been to a lot of what I did was I got an agent to represent me. You know, and he took the property and he shopped it around, and then he set up the meetings, and then we went to the meetings to pitch the idea. It was just an idea that was just too weird, too out there, because all the meetings we had during the 90s, nobody got it. They didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was about. And the idea of a fighting nun, you know, was just too out there. You know, some people thought, oh, it's too controversial. We couldn't, you know, there's no way we could do this, you know. But then my old agent left because he couldn't sell it. So after he left, I got in contact with, a guy named Dean English, who is part of Perfect Circle Productions. He contacted me and said he wanted to represent Warrior Nun, you know, around the 2000s. So, he took the property, started shopping around, and he was having the same problem, but he was more determined. than my previous thing. So it a lot depends on who you get to represent you. He has to be someone, he or she has to be passionate about your property enough to do the footwork and to sell it, you know, because that's really good. Now, some people have less problem with that because they're well known. I mean, you know, Mark Miller and all those, Kirkman, they have really good representation because, you know, they had huge successes under their belts. But they too had to start from scratch. So everyone has to start somewhere. You know, that's the important thing. It's not to be discouraged, you know, and play the long game. Now, sometimes it can happen really fast. You know, so you do a property. Let's say you do a property and it sells 1 million copies. That's an attention grabber, you know, right there. And then you can, that's a far easier to try to sell that, and especially if you have a high, what you call a high concept, you know, where you have a title that's like, you know, eye-catching and grabby, you know, and that also helps. You know, the only disadvantage to that is that you have to have a good body of work. Okay, let's say you do 2 issues of a book and it's like hot, really hot. People are, you know, oh, we're going to option this as a show, but you only have 2 issues. So how are you going to do a TV series or a movie based on something that only has 2 issues? You know, the thing about Warrior Nun is by the time we had 15 years of Warrior Nun material you could draw on, you know, over 100, 200 issues that they could do. So he was having a hard time selling it. Okay, I had run into some medical issues and I had to sell the rights to Warrior Nun to Avatar Comics. And I got a pretty good big chunk of change there to cover everything. But I lost the comic book rights to Warrior Nun. That's why Antarctic Press hasn't been doing any Warrior Nun comics, if you notice, in the last, you know, 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. But he still retained all the TV and movie rights. So he was having difficulty selling it. And then he did a sizzle reel. That's also on YouTube if you want to check it out. I'm not sure if you know what a sizzle reel is, but it's sort of like a proof of concept type thing where you show how a show could be if it was actually filmed. So he spent some money, he got a sizzle reel done, and he still didn't get any nibbles. So he contacted a friend of his named Simon Barry, who was a seasoned showrunner. Okay, now I'm not sure if you know what a showrunner is, but it's basically the writer who controls the direction of the show, you know, and he decides what. So he tweaked the property, you know, so it would be more sellable. Mm-hmm. And then he took it to Netflix, and Netflix greenlighted it, you know, which was, you know, fantastic news. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't too unusual because I'm sure Netflix was screenlighting everything back then, you know. But I was happy. It was fantastic news, you know. But they made a lot of changes to the source material, so I wasn't resistant to that because I understood, you know, things don't exactly translate from the source material into the final material, and he wanted it in a certain direction. And I thought what he did was fine, you know. It was good. It was different, you know. And we got 2 seasons out of it, and I think he's trying to get a 3rd season in another streaming services. But you know, cross my fingers. We'll see what happens.
Netflix seems like they have a 2 season. They have a thing with like the 3rd and 4th seasons of shows, like unless it's, you know, huge, like Stranger Things or something like that, they'll cut you off after 2 seasons, it seems like. Absolutely was a good show, and you know, I'm definitely excited to hear about if we do get a 3rd season anywhere, you know, on any of, and I know a lot of these streaming platforms are looking for great content, so there's definitely hope for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say if I can do it, then anybody can do it.
That's my saying. That's what I say.
That's right. Never give up hope.
That's right. Okay. All right. So now, if you're ready, Kyron, this is my favorite part of the show. Quick takes. So, if you've never seen the show before, quick takes is a rapid fire Q&A session where with our guests, where I ask you 5 questions and get 45 seconds each to answer those questions off the top of your head. So if you're ready, let's
do it. Okay, let's do it.
All right. So one thing that we didn't talk about was your creative endeavors with the Mangaverse. And I know that I want to say in the new Spider-Man movie that just came out. I'm not gonna say what happened, but we did see one of the I think the Spider-Man from the Spider-Verse was in there. So but if you were to describe the difference between manga and comics to somebody in 45 seconds, how would you describe it?
If you're talking about between Western and manga comics, I would say the biggest difference is that in Western comics, there's a sense of urgency. You know, things have to move very quickly. You know, you got to get down to the brass tacks of the story, you know, and then a lot of time it focuses on a lot of soap opera elements. In manga, it's more of a leisurely, laid back, where the stakes are not always that important, in that they're more laid back and more slice of life in terms of their storytelling, you know. And the and since it's less episodic and more of a long term thing, that's basically to me the biggest difference between the two.
Oh, I like that answer. That's a pretty good breakdown. I never even thought about that before you said it about the urgency of Western comics. Because definitely every issue there has to be some kind of
conflict.
Yeah, conflict in every issue. But that was a great breakdown. Okay, so question number 2. I won't say recently that you posted, but I saw that you posted that you were thinking about putting the stamp from the Comics Code Authority on your comic books. Do you think that we should bring back the Comics Code Authority, and why?
No, I don't think we should bring it back. It's a nice little nostalgic treat, you know. It's sort of like a little, you know, nudge nudge, wink wink to longtime comic book readers. But also, it sort of gives new readers like, what the heck is this? You know, they don't have any idea what the Comics Authority is. And the generation that's growing up now with comics, they have, you know, no idea what it means and what it symbolized. And I thought it might be a little tiny thing, a historical relic that might interest new readers into discovering what comics books were like when it did have the Comics Code Authority. So it's just basically for fun.
Absolutely. I love it. And again, Spider-Verse last night, they used it also. I think they opened both of their movies with that. So,
oh yeah, I intend to watch it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it was all right. All right. So question number 3, and we did talk about this a little bit earlier, but I want to approach it from a different standpoint. We have a lot of new comic book creators in our audience and people that want to make comics or just started making comics. If you were to give advice to a new comic book creator, would you tell them to start with one character or multiple characters or franchises to find their audience?
I would start with just starting. You know, whatever you want to do, you should just do it. You know, the thing is that you know more than anybody what you want to hope to achieve with your creation. You know, the biggest stumbling block I found with new creators is just actually getting started. You know, I mean, you may have the greatest idea locked in your head, you know, but if you don't actually put it on paper and share it with other people, it's essentially useless. So, I mean, I would say just go ahead and do whatever you find you enjoy doing, and just do it and go at it and don't stop, you know, until you're ready to stop.
I love it. Absolutely. Just starting. That's great advice for anybody at any level. Just don't let yourself get in the way and just do what you can to get started. Absolutely. Right. All right. Question number 4. Now this might be a little controversial, but in your opinion, what do you think is the bigger piece to success in comic books? Do you think it's talent or connections?
you got to have talent, and there's no question about it. Because if you don't have the talent, then you really don't have a foundation to build your creation on. Now, connections are important. A lot of things get done with connections, so that's why it's important to build bridges, you know, and not burn them. You know, the last thing you want to do, and I try to do this with every, you know, new person I, you know, meet. I try to get to know them and respect them and decide, you know, what they're trying to accomplish and what they're expecting from me, you know. And the last thing you want to do is to insult somebody who may someday be your boss. So, you know, just always treat people with respect and, you know, treat them with dignity.
Absolutely. I love it. Okay. So question number five. Now I do another show called Top Five Live where we, every week we come up with a different top five list. Okay. So, and on this show, I like to get our guests to do a top five list off the top of their heads, just to put a little pressure on you. So I want to know, in your opinion, what are the top five most impactful manga series?
For me personally, I would probably say anything by Ishimori. He's the guy who did Kamen Rider and Cyborg 009. And I grew up with Go Nagai, who was the godfather of all giant robot manga, you know. I love Rumiko Takahashi, who was, she's the master of everyday comedic comedy manga. And let's see, I also like the Tetsuhara, who does the Fist of the North Star. You know, that was an incredible manga that just redefined action, you know. So is that four?
One more.
Matsumoto, who does Space Cruiser Yamato.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, those are definitely Fist of the North Star. I want to say it was probably my first. That was probably my first manga ever, or in anime too.
Yeah,
I was probably a little too young to be actually watching that movie when it came out. But my older cousin, he put me on.
Well, you couldn't take your eyes off it for sure. You start
that started my whole journey into anime and manga, to be honest with you. So absolutely a great list. And that was Quick Take. So thank you so very much. This week, Quick Takes is sponsored by Pure Life Water. Drink water and hydrate.
The water of life.
Pure Life, if you want to actually sponsor us, you can reach out to us at fourtailspodcast@gmail.com and you can pay us for that sponsorship and endorsement, because I didn't know we were doing that now.
I'm speaking it into existence. Every week, if we don't have a sponsor, I'm just going to make up one.
Okay. Can we make up one that we actually get paid for?
Yeah, we're going to get paid for one eventually. Okay, we're going to make it happen.
All right, Ben. Well, this is the ending of our show. We thank you for being on, but we want to make sure people check you out. So where can people buy your books, check out your social media, things like that?
Well, they can read my comics on Global Comics. I also have serialized comics in web on Webtoons. If you want to buy back issues of Antarctic Press stuff, the Antarctic Press does have a Shopify site, and they also have their own website selling back issues. I do have an eBay. I don't have an eBay store, but I do publish stuff on eBay. So, and you can always just write to me directly if you're interested in, you know, I have a Facebook page where I sometimes sell artwork and back issues and things like that. So, and of course, I have a crowdfunder with and I always encourage you to take a look at that and see if it's something you're interested in.
All right, Danny, what about you? Where can people check you out?
Y'all know me. The best place to find our stuff is www.fourthwallpros.com. That's where you can find all of our comics, hats, merch, and all that good stuff. And then if you want to find me on social media, it's at The Ace Blade on all social media platforms. Kyron, where can people find you?
You can check me out at TaurusComics.com. Get all my past issues there, all 11 copies of everything I've made, with issue 12 coming out soon on Kickstarter for Saw the Lightning Wielder issue 4. You can check me out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Taurus Comics, and TikTok. Although I don't use TikTok anymore, really. But I should. I know. But if this is your first time checking out the Four Tales podcast, you can go back to our website, which is fourtalespodcast.com, listen to previous episodes, or check it out on YouTube. But join us next week, where we will have Oscar Garza from Five Meets Comics on, talking about their newest series. That'll be next week, Saturday. But until then, sayonara, goodbye, and please take care of yourselves.
Hasta la vista, baby. I want to know what it is Quick is trying to say.